You're listening to Angoth for Arts, a podcast about reading
and writing
for people who love books.
This episode was recorded on Gadigal and Bidjigal lands of the Eora Nation.
Hello, book world, and welcome to the Angoth for Arts podcast. My name is Sarah Sasson. I'm a Sydney-based author, doctor, and researcher, and I'll be your host. Every week, we'll be chatting to local authors and other members of the literary community. So let's see who we'll be catching up with this week. Jumana Abdu is an author and medical doctor. Her debut novel, Translations, was shortlisted for the Stella Prize, the Mudd Literary Prize, and the New South Wales Premier's Literary Award. In 2025, Jumana was named a Sydney Morning Herald Best Young Novelist of the Year. Hello, welcome Jumana Abdu to the Angoth for Arts podcast. It's lovely to have you here.
Hi Sarah, thanks for having me.
Pleasure. So how has your week been going? Has it been filled with a lot of book-related things or has it been a less bookish week?
Well, funnily enough, about 1 or 2 days of writing away from finishing the first draft of my second novel.
So that's exciting.
Yes, it has been a bookish week.
That's amazing. Wow, that's a big milestone. How long have you been working on? This is book two or novel two?
Book two, yeah.
Yep.
I actually write quite quickly, and I don't know if this is like a doctor thing, although I have spoken to doctors who didn't relate at all, but I just feel like so time pressured. And when I do get a chance to write, I just write voraciously and quite obsessively. So it's been on and off writing, but I started writing maybe November last year, and then I've had big gaps in between where I've been too busy, but then sometimes I'll sit down and get a lot out.
That seems quite quick to me. And yeah, I'm also insanely jealous now because the words do not come easy to me. And I definitely relate to the time poorness. Mm. And I find, yeah, when I'm working on a project, often when I'm throughout the day away from the desk, I'm still thinking about the book. And then it's kind of good to have limited time at the desk because you've kind of already sort of percolated your ideas and it's nice to get them down. But that sounds pretty fast for a second book. And is it similar or different to Translations?
It's a lot more medical, actually. Mm. So suited to this podcast, it's about two newlywed psychiatrists in a marriage of convenience who embark on a research journey across Australia to small regional towns to investigate psychiatric cases that may have a spiritual element. So it's been very fun to play with like medical anthropology and sort of the vacuum of spiritual health in a lot of Western medicine, as well as the interplay between like the psychopathology of living at a time of constant war and violence and on the land, on the people, on the globe. So it's been a really huge and complicated project, much more ambitious than Translations. And so I was sometimes writing this terror that I'm not pulling it off, but it's you always have to challenge yourself or it's not interesting.
That's a great hook. I'm already like so interested in in the project. So yeah, I love the idea of psychiatrists in a marriage of convenience. I'm very interested in that. And then yeah, even just the ideas about psychiatry and then going out of the cities and onto the land. And that's really interesting. What was it about spirituality or lack of spirituality that you were interested in exploring?
Well, I think there's a really interesting genre called spiritual realism that you see in a lot of, for example, Black women writers in America, where you could describe their work like Zora Neale Hurston or Toni Morrison as magical realism. But for these women and the communities that they're part of, the supposedly magical element of that story is part of their spiritual reality. Mm-hmm. And when I was in psychiatry, I found it really academically fascinating when I had my placements as a medical student and as a junior doctor. There was this vacuum of purpose and meaning and this understanding of the mysterious aspects of life and of the world that you find in all modern medicine in the West, I feel. And I felt so disheartened working with the patients where it was almost an unspoken consensus that this person was just meant to be muzzled and sedated until they died, essentially. And that was the role of medicine and of the hospital in their care. I wanted to play in that space of where, like, what determines sanity and what are the delusions that we all live with and what are the crossovers between what feels true to someone's soul and their spiritual and cultural beliefs versus what is like scientifically and qualitatively provable with modern medicine.
It's so fascinating because I think historically, I mean, psychiatric conditions, depression, mania, psychosis, I think they've fascinated people for a long time. And a long time, there were these, you know, people saw them as kind of, they had spiritual or mysterious elements to them. And then it's interesting looking at them through the prism of, you know, Western medicine where, you know, the genetic revolution and molecular biology, it was supposed to solve it all, right? And then, of course, we have to acknowledge, you know, leaps and bounds have been made in clinical psychiatry and, you know, a lot of pharmacology, but there's still a gap there, right? You know, and you know, a lot of people benefit from, you know, these treatments with a lot of evidence base. But I agree with you that, you know, even despite our current best pharmacological therapy, often people don't reach that place of wellness or like feeling whole again or full functionality. So what's the gap that medicine can't fill? That sort of while you're talking, that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah, I agree with you. I definitely think this, I mean, it's amazing how far medicine has come with, especially with evidence-based medicine, as you said. And I don't let any one of my characters, the believer or the skeptic, ever have total domination because I think it's important to not to give people an answer and not to be, you know, didactic. But it did force me to really consider both sides deeply. And that's really fun to play with in fiction in a way that you can't necessarily do when writing, you know, academic research.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a lot of crossover. You know, I work as an immunologist, but I see patients with chronic pain as well, sort of is an interesting one as well, because there's still a real gap there between what is currently measurable and treatable and then how these people feel within their bodies walking around. So yeah. Oh, okay. Well, I can't wait to, is there a working title or is that to be determined?
Yeah, no, there is. It's called Delusions.
Oh, Delusions. Oh, I love how it's still the one word title. So yeah, I can imagine the books on the shelf.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent. So you work, we've talked now, you work as both an author and a medical doctor. So what does that balance look like for you on a week-to-week or day-by-day basis? And how do you find your experience of working in medicine and caring for people influence your writing, although you've already sort of talked a little bit about that?
Well, the balance is very, very hard, and you can never do everything at once. When I was a medical student, it was easier because it wasn't full time, even though the hours expected, the clinical and practical hours are, you know, basically like having a full to part-time job. It was still less emotionally and creatively draining than actually working in the hospital. So I finished the first draft of Translations, my first novel, while I was in med school. And thankfully, I don't think I would have been able to finish it once I started working as an intern or a resident. You barely have time to brush your teeth, you know? So I was able to do a lot of editing and writing short stories, but to really work on a long form project and to be immersed in it, I don't think you can do with the amount of creative energy that's expended working full-time in a public hospital. So this year, because I wanted to write a second novel and I just haven't even been able to sit down and contemplate it in the last 2 years while I was working at a public hospital, I decided to take it off and do a locum year where I worked casually in different hospitals, but tried to dedicate the majority of my purpose this year towards getting a first draft of a novel done. And yeah, I don't think a lot of artists have the luxury of doing that. So it's sort of sad that most Australian artists have to have a day job, and medicine as a day job is no, you know, nothing to sniff at, but it does also give me that financial stability and the guarantee of a job long term that allows me to take off time like this.
So you're locuming as sort of like a resident medical officer, or are you in a training program?
I'm hoping to start working as a GP next year, and I made that decision because as much as I loved obstetrics and gynecology and my passion really lies in women's health, I would be, you know, I wouldn't be touching a book for the next, you know, 6 to 10 years unless it was an obstetrics textbook. Yeah. So I made that decision in the end that I probably want to work in women's health on a community basis with a bit more flexibility and control over my time as a GP and still have time to write rather than, if I wasn't writing novels, you know, maybe I would have thrown my whole life into it. But I think one thing, if I was going to do it, I wanted to do it really well. Anything that I do, I want to do really well. And I think that those amazing specialties like obstetrics and gynecology that have a huge need for especially women doctors, you can't give it half.
Well, I'm so relieved that you find the juggle difficult, because I thought if you were going to sit there and say how easy it is, it's really hard. And yeah, I applaud you for the insight and wisdom that most people can't see how difficult things are going to be, and they just sort of go for it until it's a disaster. But you seem to have thought about this a lot and have set yourself a really good path. Yeah,
it's not to say that GP is not a serious or amazing specialty. I think it's just a different amount of control over your life and working hours. But I think there are GPs that are basically doing everything up until surgery that an obstetrics and gynecologist can do, and that's what interested me.
Yeah, I kind of always loved writing and always wanted to write a book. And ironically, the time when I pretty much wrote my draft was on maternity leave, and when my medical colleagues said, when did you get the time? You know, you work full time as a doctor, and when did you get the time to write a novel? And I was like, oh, I mostly did it when I was on maternity leave. But it sort of puts in perspective how difficult and demanding the hospital jobs are, that actually maternity leave when you've got a newborn baby is considered. Well, but all of a sudden I went from working full time. I think my brain was just so used to working at a high rate. And then even when I was at home, even though it was physically really demanding working for a newborn, I just found my brain wanted to go on with something. And it was just actually this amazing, you know, blessing to have this time at home where the rest of my career just stopped. And I was like, oh, well, there were other things I wanted to do. But now, yeah, as you said, I'm finding it hard to juggle two careers, a medical career and a writing career. And especially, yeah, medical careers are extremely demanding. And I would say, you know, a big group of doctors, you know, that's their sole passion. And I think what's interesting about doctors with a creative life as well, it's really, it's part of who they are, but it's quite challenging to make it work. And creative writing is so poorly paid, and it's not even a living wage generally. So most people have to have a job, and just historically a lot of people have worked in the arts or in journalism. And so, but yeah, medicine, you know, is that job for many writers. It's an amazing career, and it's well remunerated, but the cost is really the human cost, isn't it? For like, how much of yourself can you burn without burning out? So yeah, I like your model of part-time work and writing, and I guess you can just see how you balance the two, swinging between the two. Yeah, I have one of my best friends is an obstetrician, and the training looks incredibly grueling and ironically still quite male dominated field. Yeah, so I agree with
I think on the senior end, but actually I've heard they're trying to incentivize male trainees now, because the overwhelming majority of trainees entering the program are women, and when they go on maternity leave, everybody has a crisis. So
yeah,
but I don't know. I think it's not necessarily been for the worse. I think that, you know, obstetrics and gynae has come a long way than when they were doing the husband stitch back in the 50s.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Although I have to say one of the most amazing stories I heard was a pregnant obstetric registrar, and she was must have been very close to term, and she was working her shift at the hospital, and because no one else could cover her, and she actually ended up going into labor on her shift and birthing while she was and I heard that pretty much firsthand, so I do believe that it's true. But so anyway, I'll leave you with that image. So let's talk a little bit about your debut novel, Translation, which I have my copy here. So Translations was shortlisted for the Stella Prize, the Mudd Literary Prize, and a New South Wales Premier's Literary Award. And in addition, you were named a Sydney Morning Herald Young Novelist of the Year in 2025. So how did Translations come to be? What were the germinal ideas that took hold, and what was the writing process? You've talked a little bit about that, but yeah, what the writing process for Translations?
There are a few germinal ideas, so to speak. And then once I had enough that were obsessing me and I figured out how to bring them together into one novel, that's when the novel took form in my mind. So one of the germinal ideas, for example, was this idea of self-annihilation, of reaching a point of wanting calamity to strike you to give you some relief. And, you know, people who are in a time when they feel distant from themselves, sometimes you'll hear them talk about wanting to disappear or wanting to just drive away and start fresh. And I found that a really compelling starting point for a character, because it's something really interesting to work backwards from. So that's where the protagonist, Alia, comes from. And the novel follows her, you know, it starts with her getting in a car, driving away from Sydney to a rural New South Wales with her daughter to set up her stake in a homestead, dilapidated homestead, which she then rebuilds, at first attempting to do it totally on her own, but then slowly finding the local community and all these other characters slip into her very carefully manicured life. Another idea was the power of the unsayable, which I think is a it's a difficult thing to explore in a novel that is in a form that is so embedded in the word, and not only the word, but a word at its in its most lengthy form, you know, the novel, the traditional novel, the wordiest form of expression. And it was a nice challenge for me to figure out, especially at those moments that were climaxes between the two characters where they are the missed or found connection. How am I going to explore the insufficiency of words using language? And those challenges propelled me through the book.
Yeah, interesting to hear you talk about those germinal ideas, because I think because we meet Aaliyah, we don't see the disaster that came before. We sort of meet her when she's on this road to independence. But I mean, she's such a striking and strong character. But yeah, it was interesting how it's a bit of a slow reveal what happened beforehand. But we don't spend much time in that world. Most of it is sort of the aftermath. Like that's where we start. The novel starts kind of in the aftermath of what's happened before. And that idea of those wordless moments. So, I mean, I think immediately of Aaliyah and the character of Shep, who's the local imam. Is that who you're mostly talking about there, or what other central characters were you playing with that ideas of where language?
There are sort of two characters that she flits between, as well as her friend, the midwife from the local hospital. But the two characters that she's most torn between are Shep, this very, very private Palestinian farmhand, who also happens to be the local imam for the region, so basically like a Muslim preacher, and then her old childhood friend Hannah. And they're both sort of opposites in a way, in the sense that, you know, Shep is a refugee whose language, first language, is not English, and it functions in silence for a lot of the book, unless he then breaks out into a sermon and speaks the most eloquently out of all the other characters. And for him, language is so precarious, and it's almost the line between existence and non-existence for him, because his identity and his existence are so threatened by language and by all these other forces in the world. So he cares a lot about being understood and how he expresses himself. So him and Alia, their relationship is a series of conversations that, you know, elongate as their friendship deepens and they discover new ways of talking to one another and talking around things and trying to help each other find space that isn't locked within labels or locked within language, you know, that sort of acceptance. Whereas with Hannah, her old friend, they have, you know, they both speak the same language, they grew up in the same place, they have a very similar upbringing, they went to school together, but despite that, despite all the shared vocabulary and experience they have, they understand each other the least. And everything that they say only makes them more opaque to one another and muddies the waters. In the way that, you know, someone that you meet in childhood, your friendship is so much based in things that you guys are too young to understand. And there isn't really that sense of self that you curate once you're an adult. To meet each other again as adults, suddenly there's all these barriers between them that Hannah doesn't understand, because she lives in that still amorphous sort of childish state. And Alia is so anxiously attached to. So there's these two things where one relationship is built upon this carefulness with language and this constant, you know, negotiation of it, and the other one is finally consolidated by abandoning language once and for all.
Yeah, I noticed that it both in the book and then, as a writer, you pay so much attention to language. But sometimes I feel like at the extremes of human experience, I mean, I often feel that language fails, when there's something devastating that happens, like severe grief response, or even at the other end, extreme joy. Sometimes, like, language does fail. It just, there's not enough words to choose from. And yeah, and then those moments, I'm very interested in how people relate to each other, through like body language and expression. And I think there's some really beautiful moments in translations where, two characters are almost sitting in silence, or, there's just minimal body language. But it's amazing how, the power of that as well. And I guess as humans, along with different languages, there's sort of a core, body language that has developed as well. It can sort of transcend, even people who don't speak the same language can have meaningful interactions with very limited words, and we see that in the hospital as well when we're communicating with patients, or, where there might be language barriers as well.
Well, I worked in a hospital in Western Sydney where the vast majority of our patients, English was not their first language. And, you're meant to be using a translator every time you speak with these patients. But in practice, it's often impossible in a morning ward round when you already barely have a couple of minutes to spend with each person. So, you do feel the limits of language in those times, and also the injustice of not taking time to understand how somebody communicates and to be able to actually use the language that would be most effective in giving them proper emotional care. And so it did feel the weight of being able to converse and connect with someone when you're a doctor as well in those situations.
Yeah, I think I did a lot of my training in hospitals where we used a lot of face-to-face translators, which, is like a luxury and sort of one of the better things you can do. But I think I worked in a similar area of Western Sydney. That's where I work now, but there's so many cultures and languages that the list is about, there's no one or two most common, it's about 40. But I think also what I've learned is, it's not hard to convey empathy and care. I think people know if you are truly sitting with them in their space, and it's, as well as getting the right translator on the phone. I think, yeah, like you say, like the matter of the amount of time and the quality of time, and yeah, there are so many ways to convey your care and empathy while you wait for the correct translator to come online on
Oh, it's such a gamble. I mean,
the
once I had a phone translator for an Arabic speaking patient, and I can speak Arabic, but I wanted someone who could, who's ostensibly trained in complex medical conversations, just in case, because I always thought my Arabic was too conversational. And I could hear her telling the patient the wrong things, and the patient kept looking at me so confused. And eventually I just had to hang up. Like, you know what? We're going to have to get by with what I've got because this is not helpful.
There you go. You can also get jobs as a translator. So we talked in translation, we follow the protagonist, Alia, who's left her marriage and the big city to start anew in rural New South Wales with her daughter, Sakina. So Alia is a fiercely independent Muslim woman, and she's juggling the demands of raising Sakina, her daughter, nursing in the local hospital, and restoring this property, as you've mentioned, and developing its permaculture with the help of Shep, who we've talked about, who's the local imam. There's tension when Alia reconnects with a childhood friend, Hannah, who is now living in vulnerable circumstances, and then later in the novel, the threat of bushfire that encircles the region. When I read it, I felt strong themes around colonization, dispossession, empowerment, vulnerability, faith, and the idea of a magnetic attraction. But I was very interested in your setting of the novel in rural New South Wales, centering on a farm property. And I've since read some reviews that reflect on how translation expands our understanding of the Australian bush narrative. For me, the isolated setting and the process of rebuilding informed my understanding of Alia's strength and her determination. And it also worked as a nice vehicle to draw other characters into the world. For example, Shep, who comes to help rejuvenate the land, and Hannah, who comes to seek refuge at the house. So how important to you was it to set the novel in a rural setting in Australia?
Thank you for that really considered response to the book, first of all. And yeah, you're right. It's such a handy tool to have a house in a novel. A house novel is it you know it has a it's all its traditions. And it was it does give people a role and something to build together, which is helpful for emotional progression. In terms of the rural setting, part of me, I was writing it in as the pandemic isolations were slowly melting away, and I think a lot of people had this fantasy of going rural and buying a house, and that was the reality for a lot of people. I was reading articles about people buying richer, wealthier city people buying up houses in the Northern Rivers, for example, where pe the people who actually lived in that community and had grown up there could no longer afford the financial risks of the devastation posed by climate change. So it was this really complex situation of gentrification where the people who lived there couldn't afford to live there anymore, not because necessarily people were buying them out, but because of climate change and insurance and these sorts of things. This was right after the floods and the fires had hit the same region. And so the people who could afford those risks were buying up the land and having their little getaways. So I was indulging this fantasy of writing a novel in the countryside, a sort of bush gothic where you have, mysterious characters in an old house, etc. But at the same time, I didn't want to just write, a fake fantasy. I wanted it to be grounded in the real world and to hold Ahlia accountable for her role in this community, coming as a fairly wealthy outsider in a place that has been loved and looked after by a diverse community that I think reflects modern rural Australia in a way that some people find surprising, but all the actual people who I've spoken to who grew up regionally don't find surprising at all, which has been really nice.
I guess I hadn't really thought of this this bush narrative until I read the review, and I was like, oh, is that what she was trying to do? But I think it adds another layer to the story. I remember I trained up in Lismore on the Northern Rivers, and obviously it's devastated to see the issues with the flood. And lots of people aren't able to rebuild where their houses were. But I also remember when I worked there was lots of Sydney's population and community there, and really and the local community very embracing of them. And like you say, it's not all the old tropes and stereotypes aren't holding anymore with modern Australia and resettling patterns and where people are immigrating to. So it's nice to see. I like that idea of that our modern canon of literature needs to reflect the reality as well, and that those kind of diversity doesn't just exist in the big cities. So nice to see that. So when I picked up translations, I remember there was this breathtaking line on the very first page, which I'll read now. Yeah, but it comes very early in the novel, so there's no spoiler alerts. Across the years, disaster after disaster had sounded sirens through her life, like a city wailing evacuation. This is from Aaliyah's point of view. And when I read that, I knew I was in the hands of a masterful storyteller. Do you remember where you were when you wrote that line?
Thank you. Thanks. Interestingly, that line was one of the last things that I finished editing, even though it's so early on in the novel. I remember being right at the end of the editing process and still tweaking that line in particular. I think it was just the wording that was tricky to nail down, and that was the shortest version of what I came up with in the end. I think, as a rule, when I first started, I was very overwordy, and since then, working with my editor, Melissa Lane, I learned the power of saying less. And that was one of those sentences that right at the end I decided to shave down. And the translation initially started with a whole chapter detailing all these disasters that you mentioned earlier you didn't see happen to Alia, you only saw the aftermath. Well, I actually initially, the first chapter spoke about all these disasters in chronological order and in a lot of depth. But the mentor that I was working with for the next chapter fellowship that I had with the Wheeler Centre, Hannah Kent, was my mentor, and which was an
Pretty,
it
pretty
was just
amazing to have as a
she,
mentor.
yes, just the unbelievably amazing and such a privilege, and better than I can explain. But one of the first things that she said to me after reading the novel was, "Have you considered starting with chapter two?" And when she said that, it didn't shock me. I didn't get offended. It just suddenly clicked to me that, yes, that's exactly what needs to happen. And it was quite liberating, actually, to just chop it. And I sprinkled in that backstory elsewhere, but a lot of it, the reader didn't need to know. So there was only almost all the remnant of that first chapter is just in that line you picked out about disaster after
That's why
disaster.
it's so powerful, because you can it's still got the fumes of all the chapters before. So it must have been the first draft must have been quite long. I'm really
It was.
fascinated. I want to know the word count of that
Oh,
first draft.
it was 135,000 words. And actually, one of the first things, actually, the first thing Hannah said to me was, "Have you considered that it's quite a long book?" And I thought, oh, God.
Oh, see, so fascinating. So I have the opposite problem. So I'm a real, words for me is like blood from a stone. And then I write things, and every time I edit them, I lose words. So I finished my first draft, and this is funny. My first draft was 55,000
Oh my
words,
goodness.
and all the editors were like, "This is this like what is this? Is this a long novella or like a very short book?" So I had to sort of claw my way up to 70,000. But I'm always in awe of of people who write so
No,
many words. I
I
think we
would
just
not.
have different problems.
Yeah,
You
exactly.
could send me some words in the post. That's so interesting as well, because when you're writing the first draft, often as the author, we need that backstory and we to get into the frame of mind of the character. So that's amazing that you actually had yeah, I guess chapter one, going through the details, but maybe, you know, that was part of the process. Like you needed to write through that to get to the, to understand Alia and then move on.
Definitely.
But isn't it amazing the power of editors, how, because they're on the outside of the relationship between you and the book, they see things with such clarity.
Yeah, and it's so good to have a second pair of eyes, and I'm really missing that at the moment because I've only been writing by myself without the prospect of having a mentor. I have some very generous friends who've offered to read the first draft of the novel for me once I finished it, but it feels scarier than it did with translations because, number one, when I wrote my first draft of translations, I didn't expect anyone would ever read it. I didn't know I would ever get published. And then when I finally, when it did become a reality or possibility, I had a very structured mentorship, and then all these people who were very generously offering to read it who were not that close with me, so it felt quite professional. And now I feel like I've lost the safety net a little bit, and also that more eyes are on me, but I'm trying not to think about it.
Yeah, I know, just the absolute liberation of being a complete, you know, unknown, unpublished writer. We'll never have that again. And then it was acquired by Vintage. And so presumably there was another in-house editing process.
Yeah. So I had written about 10,000 words of the novel when I applied for the next chapter fellowship. And then I forgot about it completely and finished the rest of the novel. And about a week after I finished it, I got a call from them saying I had the mentorship. So I was like, great, I have a full manuscript to work with. I really had no idea what was coming because I didn't understand anything about publishing at all. And then working with Hannah was great, but also it was really helpful to have someone who could walk me through what is a publisher, what is an editor, what is an agent, and all these industry things that you just don't understand from the outside. And when I finished that 1 year mentorship with Hannah, where we had done a few structural edits and then some line edits, the Wheeler Center helped to set us up with a literary agent by just putting us in contact, but it was up to the agents to accept us. And I thankfully got a recommendation from Hannah for her own agent at Curtis Brown, which is it's the biggest agency. So they have a lot of resources, which is what I was looking for. And then they sent it out to a few different publishers, and I decided to go with Vintage/Penguin in the end. And I was worried about going with a big publisher because you worry about not having personalized working relationship and that you might get lost in the machine. But actually, it was extremely personalized. And the publisher, Meredith Kernow, put me with the best editor I could have asked for, Melissa Lane. She was so culturally sensitive, but also very literary and rigorous in her editing, taught me a lot so that it wasn't just prescriptive, but actually enabling me to become a better writer for my next project, and really interested and on the same page as me. So it was a perfect, beautiful working relationship. They were they gave me a lot of special treatment, I think, because, you know, they gave me a lot of different options for book covers and things like that. So that took about a year. But I also did of my own accord, reach out to a few different diverse writers before I sent it to an agent, because I was worried that once it reached an agent, only white people would read it and it might not get that community feedback. So I did reach out to some friends and peers to give me other sorts of perspectives. But in the end, you know, that wasn't the case when it came to going through the industry.
Were you worried about that it would get edited in a way that would only appeal to certain demographics, or?
No, not that. More that it would just get a thumbs up. And I didn't want someone who to just be like, yeah, that's great. I wanted someone who would take it seriously. And you know, I worried that sometimes, you know, this is just the idea that I had, that white industry workers would read it and be like, yeah, it's great, it's diverse, whatever. Actually, that wasn't the case in the end. So, I mean, I was taken very seriously, and Melissa had a special training, actually, and I think she's on the Multicultural Board of Editors or something like that. But that was just the worry that I had. So I reached out to people who I felt were going to hold me accountable culturally and in terms of my politics and my ideas. And that was good to have that confidence going in.
Yeah, that's interesting. But I think also, sharing it with culturally diverse colleagues and writers, because they could probably edit and suggest things to you in a way that, like I think maybe a lot of white industry people, you know, that it would also be fear, like they would probably have a fear of saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing, even if their intentions were good, because they just wouldn't have that cultural knowledge. But it's so wonderful to hear that you've had such a positive publishing journey, and then you've published with a mainstream publisher, but in a way that, you know, has been celebrated in your community and other communities as well. So it sounds like you trod the line well, and you got to where you
was very
wanted to go.
lucky.
Yeah, I think, and that idea as well, when you go in with your debut novel, you know, first of all, you really want to get the book published. But then I remember just this, I had no idea what lay beyond that, like the actual mechanisms or what happened yet. And then I was never really sure, you know, am I allowed to have an opinion, or how much can I push back, or yeah, who owns the text now, or yeah, and you're sort of feeling your way through it. But just looping back to what you said before with the second book, but I think just the experience, even though it's scary doing it for the second time, you know, both we would have learned so much from the first time. You know, at least you know what is behind the doors now. Yeah,
I
so
think
you have.
I am just objectively a better writer, and that comes with writing hundreds of thousands of words and then learning to edit them, and also the tools that I've been given by the really generous people who helped me along the way. So I do have to remind myself that, because I think it's the same with medicine. You look back, you forget how little you knew when you started, and it just you think that you don't know that much, whatever level you're at, no matter how senior. But when you forget how little you really did know when you started
Oh,
out.
it happens to me all the time. I still feel like I don't know enough, or don't know nearly anything. And then, yeah, often it's when an experience of going to teach, you know, first year medical students, and I catch myself and go, okay, maybe I do know a few things after like several decades.
Yeah,
But
just a few.
but I think it's a bit sort of, it's subconscious, that learning, and it all kind of happens so quickly. But yeah, that's exciting. So we were part of the 2025 Sydney Writers Festival on a panel called the STEMinist Book Club, together with the wonderful Melanie Cheng and our facilitator, Caroline Ford. How have you found the post-production experience of interviews, writers' festivals, and other appearances, which are so different from the process of writing? And have there been any particularly memorable occasions?
Well, and I'm not just saying this, but that was one of my favorite panels. It was really interesting, and I just felt like, you know, when there's just electricity on a panel, you don't always get that. It comes down to chemistry a lot of the time. The questions were interesting and they were specific, and it was just a really new angle. I loved it. So
It was, I mean, yeah, I thought that
it
electricity was just like my nervous energy as I was about to crumble before going on
No, it
stage.
was great. And it was such in such an open space with so many people spilling out, and I really did feel that despite all the distractions around, everyone was really, you know, locked in, which was great. So that was a great experience. And then a really randomly great panel that I was on that I was quite nervous about, actually. It was in Sorrento, Writers Festival. Sorrento is like where the richest, wealthiest, you know, people in Victoria go to retire. And I saw a lot of designer clothing there, and a lot of pearl earrings, and and so it was an interesting crowd. And I was put on a panel with, they're quite established commercial writers. One does crime fiction and the other one does women's fiction, so they had a lot of fans in the room, and we're all so different. I mean, like, we had absolutely nothing in common as writers except that we loved writing. But it was just like explosive chemistry. Seth Robinson was our facilitator, and we were just all going. It was great. We barely followed the structure whatsoever, and it was, you know, hilarious and interesting and invigorating. I loved it.
Oh, I love that story. Yeah, I think it's so interesting when you turn up to panels and often they just don't go the way you think they're going to go. Yeah, I'm so glad you love the Sydney Writers Festival panel as well. Yeah, I kind of did this weird thing in the lead up. I kind of talked myself into the fact, oh, it was going to be really small and no one was going to come because it was like free and it was on an open stage and like it was a Saturday. And I think it was just like some kind of mental game I was playing with myself. And then we turned up and like the whole bay is packed. But I think one of the things I loved about that panel was because we talked about so many other things around our book, you know, a lot of it was about the process of being a doctor or being a writer or medical themes or juggling all that. And so we weren't sort of, because I think a lot of time when you put a book into the world, you kind of get trapped into these broad headings and you end up talking about the same things over and over again. But that's what I really loved about the STEMinist panel, was a little bit different. But yeah, it reminded me of when I went to Byron Writers Festival and I was on two panels. One about books that dealt with sort of like complex family dynamics. And then the second one was all about grief. And I was kind of dreading the grief one because I thought it was just going to be, I was like, going to be a real, really taxing and like depressing. But yeah, similar to your panel, the grief panel somehow was just electric and everyone was so open and vulnerable. But then we had those moments of humor and Yeah, and anyway, it just totally broke all my expectations. But I think it's funny as an author and probably as an audience member, you turn up to these things and you don't actually know what you're going to get. They're kind of a surprise package, and often because often the panelists have never met before. Like off sometimes we have, but sometimes we hardly know each other, and so it's that chemistry of meeting people in the flesh for the first time.
I did remember the names of the writers, by the way. It's Sally Hepworth and Christian White. Sally Hepworth writes, she's got a,
She's like women's like commercial
yes,
fiction.
she had a
Yes,
lot of
yeah.
fans in the room, and Christian White writes the crime novels.
I read an interview with the Stella Prize, and I love this quote. You said, "If I'm ever not working on a new project, I'm gone." And that you've been writing novels since you were very young. So I wanted to ask, what is writing to you? What does it give to you? And what does it give to you?
The other day at the Blue Mountains Writers Festival, I drew a parallel between how I feel about writing and the DSM-5 classification of an addictive disorder. Because when I think when it occurred to me on the stage, and I think it's relevant here, an addiction is something that takes you away from your loved ones, that you aren't able to stop, that you feel like you've lost control over in your life, affects your eating, your sleeping, and your finances. And when you don't have the time to do it or engage in it, then you feel
You've
agitated
got
and you feel
withdrawal.
withdrawals. And that's
Wow.
really what writing is like to me. I think I've been writing novels since I was, 11 years old, and it's just something that I need to do when, in the times when I haven't been doing it, I felt quite miserable and agitated. And it's my tongue in a lot of ways. I think other people are able to express themselves in a conversation, and I need 100,000 words to get something out. So
You wrote your
that's.
first book at 11. You wrote a
Well, I
book at
started
11.
it. I started at 11 years old. It was a ripoff of Peter Pan.
I was trying to I was going to ask you about Peter Pan, because that comes through in translations. There's quite a few Pan references, and I
A
wanted to
little
ask
nod
you,
to myself.
to
Well, the
you.
book does go back and forth between childhood, teenagehood, and the current timeline in adulthood. So I think Peter Pan is not, it's actually a novel about the tragedy of loving someone who, in order to love them, you have to leave them as they are and cannot, if Peter was to be with Wendy forever, he wouldn't be himself anymore. He would be an adult, and his essence is something that is, unattainable. And I found that, as a child, that really shaped my understanding of romance and love and tragedy. Also, I love the idea of the shadow and, Tinkerbell and all these things. I dropped little references to that throughout the book as an homage to my earlier writing days.
I did pick up on that. So, yeah, because I feel, do you feel writing, are you exploring new ideas, or do you think subconsciously are you processing what's going on in your life or the world around you? Because I feel very much like it helps me process the world. And there's this quote that I love from Michael Ondaatje, and he says, "I don't know what I love till I write it out." And often, even on a subconscious level, I'm writing, and I don't know how I feel about something, or nothing makes sense until I write it out. And then when it's on the page, I can kind of see it more clearly. Do you have feelings like that?
Yeah, I think James Baldwin said that every writer just writes the same novel over and over again, or something like that. Every writer has their tick that they return to. And I can see echoes of themes that I began exploring in translations in an evolved form in my next long work. And I see a lot of recurrent themes in my short stories. My editor said once she read a short story that I had written, and she said it's very different from the other ones, but it's also very clearly a story written by you because it has such and such things in it. And she listed these tropes or these qualities that a Jemana Abdul story has. I never realized that I was doing that in everything that I write. So yeah, I think the answer is both yes and no. And I definitely agree with writing to understand yourself. I try not to write as therapy, but I do write to understand my life, which I think is something that Joan Didion said in a much more eloquent way as well.
It's interesting. I was recently on holidays in Sri Lanka, and there was like a free book library, and I was, finished my book, and I went, and there was Elizabeth Strout's second novel, and I'm a big Elizabeth Strout fan. I love her work, and but it was called Abide by Me, and I just picked it up, and I love going back and reading my favorite writer's early books, and it was fascinating. It's all set,
in New England, where a lot of her novels are set, and it's very, yeah, interesting ruminations about faith and human frailty. But yeah, so much of her themes, because she probably didn't break through until, later with Olive Kitteridge and the Lucy Barton series. But yeah, it was fascinating to go back and read her second novel, and it was still very much an Elizabeth Stroud novel, and still a beautiful turn of phrase. And yeah, so that's interesting. But I think, yeah, it's almost like we're ruminating. Yeah, and often it builds into something bigger, or the ideas change and evolve. But yeah, stylistically, and yeah, our central themes probably aren't going to change, but they'll yeah bounce the light in a different way.
Exactly. Yeah, I like that, bouncing the line a different way.
All right, this always happens. I feel like, we have plenty of time, and then here we are at the end. So last question. So yeah, what book are you reading now, or is there another book you've read recently that you would recommend to listeners?
The book I'm reading right now, I've come to it quite late, so I could recommend it, but I feel everyone's probably read it already. The Boat by Nam Lee.
Oh yes, yep.
Just so brilliant. I think I put it off reading it for so long because I wasn't ready to, digest how good it was going to be. But it's so irreverent and serious about the craft, and I'm loving it. But a book that I would recommend to everyone from something I've read this year was My Friends by Hisham Attar. Just one of the most moving and exquisitely written novels I've read in a long time. So full of love and humanity and so propelling. I've been recommending it to anyone who asks me for a recommendation.
Amazing. Thank you. Well, we'll put both of those in the show notes. And I think books don't have read by dates. And a lot of people say that, better late than never, but also, they come into to our lives when they're supposed to. So do you find you read a lot when you're working on a big project? Are you still reading a lot at the same time, or you kind of have to slow it down,
Yeah, no, it's
grinds to a halt?
definitely. When I'm really in a writing flow, I'm only writing, and reading something just makes me want to put it down and go back to writing because it stimulates ideas. But in between writing, I'm either reading heaps or watching a lot of great films to help me
Yeah,
write.
to feel it's and it's funny what you said about the boat. I think sometimes when you're writing and then you read like an amazing writer, like it's quite confronting how good some writers
Ugh.
are.
It can be devastating,
Yeah,
really.
it's
So
devastating. Like, I can't
disheartening.
read this for the entertainment
No.
because like the craft is just it's upsetting to me how talented these people are. Jemana, yeah, just one of the most intelligent, engaging, and eloquent writers around, I believe, in my humble opinion. So it's been such a thrill to get to know you. I'm so happy to meet another Doctor Who writes. And please don't stop doing one or the other, because I need someone like you to be a
Thanks,
beacon
Sarah.
to show me that it's possible.
Well, this is such a good conversation, and you'll have to invite me back again to speak one day because I really loved it. Thank you.
Okay, I love it. All right, have a good day. Bye.
Thanks, you too. Bye.